welcome to Question Time live from the Intercontinental Hotel in Berlin, where we have Online Educa Berlin, and we're broadcasting this live Question Time event today on DS106. Just a few facts and figures about Online Educa. There's 2 pre-conference fora, 13 pre-conference workshops and seminars, 23 topic areas, 84 parallel sessions, 14 keynote speeches, and 360 speakers from 43 countries. And the organisers claim that it's the largest corporate and public sector e-learning conference in the globe. Okay, enough for our panel today. We have 4 panellists. And we have Shafika Isaacs, who is from Cape Town, South Africa, which means she said she's got a Cape Townian accent attitude and a wicked sense of humour. And I hope we're going to be seeing that wicked sense of humour on Question Time today, Shafika.
Let's see.
Now, we've got Raymond Elfrink, who actually refused to give me a written CV, which I could read out, but tells me that he used to be a nuclear physicist, but he decided that he'd become a computer programmer because he could do more damage in that. So welcome, Raymond. And then I've got, trying to find my notes here, Yishay Moore on my left. Yishay combines a background in computer science with a design perspective on educational research, practice and professional development. He's currently leading the Learning Design Grid theme team of Stellar Network of Excellence. And Yishay aims to perfect the art of intellectual nomadism, whatever that might be. And he says something good will surely come of this eventually. And then we have Grona Knoll, who is lost on my list here. She's a professor of learning innovation at the University of Leicester. Her research interests include learning design, open educational resources, learner experience, and social participatory media. She's an active user of social media, including Facebook and Twitter. And she's got a blog and a social networking site, Cloudworks, which some of you may know. And she says she's likely to go down in history as the person who killed off all the animals in the media zoo. Do you want to tell us what those animals were?
Lots and lots of animals, otters and ostriches and cheeky impalas and various other animals.
So the animals are going from the Leicester Media Zoo.
We're going to release them humanely into the wild, of course.
Okay, and if you are on Twitter, you're listening to this live, we'll be trying to monitor the Twitter feed. You can put your tweets in by Twitter and use the hashtag #OEB11, and we'll be trying to follow that feed and questions. Meanwhile, we've got questions for the audience, and the first question today is going to be from Martina Doolan. Martina, what's your question?
My question to the panel is, given the explosion in social media, it could be argued that students are doing it for themselves, in other words, are teaching themselves, and that the teacher may be replaced by technology or become redundant because of the social media, the technology. What does the panel think?
So are teachers going to become redundant? Shafika?
Well, I speak largely from an African context because that is where I've worked extensively over the last 15 years. And it is a continent where there, according to the latest UN report, is a dire shortage of qualified, motivated, well-paid teachers, and where there's a need for something like 1.9 million teachers in order to reach the Education for All goals by 2015. It is also a continent where the vast majority of learners, and I'm assuming you're talking about learners in both schools and universities, the vast majority of learners who are privileged enough to have access to formal education in Africa do not have access to social media in the way it is experienced in countries where there is ubiquitous access. However, there are numerous cases where learners have demonstrated an ability to learn learn in a self-directed, self-paced way using cell phones in very remote communities in Africa. But even under those circumstances, there's still a dire need for teacher-facilitated learning, whether it is on subject matter, mathematics, biology, science, or whether it is about life-related lessons. In Africa, one of the big issues that we are addressing is the HIV/AIDS pandemic, which is a huge challenge. And central to that is a conversation around sex and sexual attitudes and sexual behavior. And often it is helpful to have a teacher-facilitated conversation, assuming, of course, that they are sufficiently open-minded and trained to have those conversations with young people. But under those circumstances, teachers are absolutely necessary. And in my view, not just in Africa, but all over the world, they will continue to be absolutely necessary forevermore.
Thank you. Raymond, your view on this?
I have a much shorter view. I think that as long as learners are not redundant, teachers will not be redundant. But I think that tasks might shift a bit, where learners and teachers are not just persons, but roles that people take. So,
Gronje, your view?
Yeah, I mean, I also agree. I think it is true that a lot of learners are using social media in lots of different ways to support their learning, to connect with family and friends, etc. But I think there are two issues. One, there's a kind of discord between those students who like social media and those students who hate it. The question I always ask when I'm in a room like this is, how many people are on Facebook? So hands up. So about half the people. How many people hate Facebook? Okay. So why do you hate Facebook? It's the devil incarnate. That's exactly what my elder daughter says, and she thinks I'm addicted. So we all have very strong views about these social media, and so do our students. So that's a kind of key issue. I think the other thing is just because students are digitally connected and technologically immersed does not mean necessarily they know how to use these kind of technologies for their learning. So I think there are real issues. Good students are using these technologies effectively. Weaker students are even more lost. So my feeling is that roles will change, I would agree, and that the roles will shift more towards support and guidance, accreditation, and effective learning pathways for learners. So no, I don't think teachers will be redundant. In many ways, they'll be even more important.
Yeah, I don't know of, and I don't know if any of the other panelists know of any studies that shows that the way that people are learning, including ourselves, learning through social networks, is really effective. I mean, we all use social networks as part of a sort of broader collection of practices. So we use Twitter to participate in a learning community. Right, but that's because we're already members of a learning community. When you think about teenagers, I don't know exactly how they're using social networks and whether they're actually using it to learn effectively. Whereas on the other hand, you have phenomena like, you mentioned sexual behavior. So, again, phenomena like sexting, which I'm not necessarily, putting it as kind of, the image of the devil. But what I'm saying is that social networking simply makes life much more complex. And teachers need to be able to help and guide learners through that complexity. So the question is not whether teachers are made redundant, but whether teachers know how to teach the right things for the world we're moving into.
I mean, our panelists are all a bit agreeing here, yeah. But Alejandro says if teachers fear being replaced by tech, then they should be.
Yeah. Just a quick comment. Another approach to that very question is a statement made by the likes of Saugata Mitra and others, including Negroponte, who make the point that actually students are becoming teachers as well. They teach them. They teach each other, and that is again related to the change in roles. And that in fact, teachers are also learners, and that there are quite a few studies where they have shown how learners and certainly children are amongst the best teachers when they have to teach each other new concepts and new things. And what they also make a very important point, and that is that we know enough, so it is argued, about the learning brain, but what we don't know enough of is the teaching brain under specific contexts. And I think that perhaps opens up a huge research gap and something to explore in varying contexts.
Can I want respond? To respond to Alejandro.
Okay, you've got half a minute each.
Yeah. Well, on the one hand, you're right. On the other hand, I don't think it's the fear of teachers that they will be replaced by technology, but it's the fear of teachers may more be that they fear that the policymakers don't understand what the exact roles are of themselves or of the technology. That, so it's not that they fear the technology, but they probably fear the inability of policymakers to make the right decisions.
You see?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we've been hearing this question, oh, there's this great new technology people can learn, therefore we don't need teachers, and it reflects a misunderstanding, a misconception of the act of teaching. Now, getting back to what Shafika was saying about, you know, projects like OLPC or Hole in the Wall, I think those are great projects, but you have to remember that there's always this sort of power curve effect where, you know, there will be a small percentage of a population which will be able to guide themselves and lead themselves effectively through learning, and the vast majority still needs, you know, competent adults to lead them, right?
Okay, thank you, Yashe, and thank you. Martina, your view on it. You asked the question. What do you think?
I'm in agreement in terms of when using technology in a blended format, so for example, to support classroom activity or activity outside the classroom, so where students are campus-based, I agree with the concept of a tutor as a facilitator and a facilitator of a dialogue or conversation between students. I think that becomes a little bit more difficult when we go online. In relation to the policymakers and decisions that have been taken by policymakers, I know that a number of universities in the UK have targets I know the University of Hertfordshire has targets of 25% of delivery is going to be online. And I think one of the things for the tutor is it does change the role, the emphasis of what an academic or what a tutor does. And I think what's really important is to send the message to policymakers that it's really important to provide the appropriate support, both for learners, as Gwanyu said, in terms of not assuming that learners know how to use the different technologies, but also the support for academics, for tutors, who are then going to be the facilitators or the guiders of that learning whilst online. So I think that message I would like to deliver, and I think most of the panel really hit on that.
Oh, thank you, Martina. You're listening to Question Time. Question Time is a special Pontedusky production for Online Educa Berlin. And we'd like to welcome our audience, especially from Canada and USA. And yes, CogDog, it is Graham Atwell. Indeed, I didn't introduce myself. It is Graham Atwell cheering. And I love all the comments about they're talking sex on the radio. Yes, we have been talking sex on the radio. And that certainly seems to be enlivening our radio audience on Twitter, with some very funny comments about it. But we're on to our second. And feel free to keep Twittering away and use that OEB hashtag. #OEB11. Okay, our second question today comes from Hugh Fitzpatrick. Hugh, your question to the panel, please.
My question is that Jeff Borden, in his keynote speech, mentioned that now with data cluster monitoring, we can catch failing students earlier and we can stick them in with clusters of A-grade students and therefore improve their grades. I just thought, given that there are more usually failing students than A-grade students, what would the panel do with the rest of the students?
Okay. What would the panel do with the rest of the students? I'm going to start with you, Shay, on this one.
Actually, I want to say about that part of the keynote. Didn't you find that frightening? I mean, you know, that sort of, you know, kind of kettling of people in cluster. And, you know, I used to be a computer scientist, so I can appreciate data mining. But I think it's very powerful, and the whole field of data of learning analytics is really on a boom. But there's also always the risk of simplistic interpretation of data. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we don't complement what we get from data analytics with then, you know, qualitative and ethnographic views and understanding of teaching practices and learning practices, you know, this is something that, you know, could lead us, you know, headstrong on very bad path. And that idea of, oh, you know what, I can take this student and put him in this group seems to be, you know, I mean, from a teaching perspective, you know, it seems completely bonkers to me.
Gronje, your view on this. Can you kettle your students, kettle your animals in the media zoo?
Poor animals. I think this is an interesting point. I think the whole area of learning analytics, which has emerged recently, is going to be potentially very powerful for us better understanding the nature of our students, how they're interacting with technologies, so that we can identify those who are failing. I don't think necessarily putting them in with good students is the solution. I think it's about identifying what kind of problems they're having, mm-hmm. and hence coming up with tailored solutions to support them in different ways. That could include mixing good with weaker students. It could include peer mentoring of different forms. It might include budding schemes where you connect them with older students, for example. So I think there's a range of ways in which it can be done. So I don't think it's just about mixing good and weak students.
Raymond, some people say it's the computer scientists who are now taking over and using just algorithms for kettling students and dividing them. Is it your fault?
Yes. Can I first? I first want to start with mentioning sex again on the radio. The thing is that with the first about the data mining thing, this is clearly something where people are trying to have macroscopic goals and then impose them on microscopic systems. So a single learner, you don't treat a single learner the same way as you treat, you know, the body of students in the UK, for instance, where you say, oh, we want to have this, you know, we want to have so many people on this level by 2015. You cannot have plans on that level and then impose them on a single person. So, and I think it's appalling to speak about individual people by saying, oh, well, if we move them there, then they're, you know, they're improving. We are probably to blame as computer scientists, but we don't know better. We have no social skills.
Okay.
Thank you. I think Jeff Borden was speaking predominantly from an American context or American-European context. I think for me what that suggests, your question suggests, is that it is very much context-specific as to why it is that students fail. And certainly in an African context, very broadly, we not only have the problem of high failure rates, not only do we have the problem of limited literacy and numeracy performance in school, but also very high dropout rate. And to give you a frightening statistic, the average 15-year-old in sub-Saharan Africa is not in school. And often the reasons for that is highly complex and very much related to conditions of poverty. And the response, therefore, to addressing something as complex and that in a context-specific way is to look at it from a community perspective and involving the community in nurturing and supporting learners who drop out of school. And whether they can be integrated into the community or labor market, whether formal or informal, or back into a learning environment, and to support students who, from a community perspective, also who are failing by involving groups and communities of teachers and parents who are able to support learners. Yeah.
Thank you, Speaker. Can we go back to the original questionnaire was Hugh Fitzpatrick? Hugh, what's your view?
I just thought that Jeff's figures didn't add up on that one. I very much agree with what Raymond says, that you know, you can't necessarily apply kind of broad-scale ideas from macroscopic ideas onto a kind of individual institutions. And usually, speaking as a teacher, you know, usually when students are failing or whatever in an individual institution, you know it, and you know, you try and do something about it. It's not a lack of data.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to move on to another question. Meanwhile, keep the questions coming in on Twitter. We will be taking some of your questions. Remember, hashtag OEB11, and we are trying to follow the feed. Okay, our next question is from Carsten. Carsten Kuzanki. I can't quite read your writing.
That's a hard Carsten. One. In many presentations, discussions, debates around e-learning, ICT and learning, etc., I've seen many speakers demanding new pedagogical approaches. Yes, I don't want to be provocative. I'm just asking, do you know any new pedagogical approaches?
Okay, to the panel. Do you know any new pedagogic approaches? I'm going to take Gronje, you first.
What a surprise. I did a review of different pedagogies and the way in which they're being used across different technologies, particularly building on the work that Terry Mays and Sara de Freitas did in 2004 for JISC. They categorised pedagogies into associative, things like behaviourist didactic approaches, constructivist and situative. And to that I added a fourth, which is the controversial notion of connectivism from George Siemens and Stephen Downs in Canada. But I think, despite the fact that there are arguments about is this really a pedagogy or not, I think there's something in the notion of network learning that is distinct and different. There's something about the collective, the kind of scale of aggregation that brings us something new and different, I think, to a learning context. And I think it relates back a little bit to Martina's question as well about how students are participating in this area. I think there probably are new pedagogies, but it's not quite clear what they are yet. And I think it's an area that we really do need to work on.
Raymond, what's your view on this?
You can classify pedagogies, which is interesting, but an actual pedagogy is probably when you apply one of these classifications or something into a real-life situation. And probably there are new approaches being developed all the time by individual teachers or by people, and then if they don't write them down and they disappear again and are reinvented, probably.
Shafika, new pedagogies, you know any?
Well, I think I would agree with the comment that it is an emergent phenomenon, and there probably are new pedagogies emerging. I know of one experience in South Africa where a self-organizing a learning system had emerged among young people who are using an online chat platform using their mobile phones, where they download novels released in teenage novels released in a series format like a soap opera every second day in a local language, in a local African language like isiZulu or isiXhosa. And what that has sparked off is a very interesting engagement amongst young people about the issue, and often the issue is about sex, and it surfaces a whole host of questions about how young people engage around sex. And in that way, what it has highlighted is certainly a new literacy, because they use their own text-based language, a code, and also a new genre, which is this sort of teen novel, which speaks very much to the heart of issues that are affecting teenagers, like sex.
And thank you, Yishe. I think you've not answered.
Well, I'm just impressed by it. Yes, exactly. That's the Infralit project, right? I mean,
Infralit. That's right.
I love that project. And yes,
it's great.
It's great host thing. But the thing is, I think that the fact that sex come in again sort of shows a change in balance between the teachers and the learners. I mean, suddenly learning is about the issues that interest the learners. It's not dictated from above. I think the technology has the effect of changing that balance of power and positioning a teacher in a different place. And if you're willing to accept that different place, then you could do great stuff as a teacher. If not, you're sort of heading into a wall. Right. Now, the other thing is, I think technology also enables us to sort of reinvent old pedagogies. So, for instance, collaborative learning has been around, well, probably since Socrates, right? But collaborating on a piece of paper is different than collaborating on a shared Google Doc. Yeah, it brings in different epistemic practices. And collaborating when you're all in the same room is different than when you're out and about using mobile phones to access the same information and contribute to a discussion while you're on the move, seeing different aspects of the world. So again, technology enables new epistemic practices, which we can harness into our learning practice if we notice them and understand them.
Okay, thank you. Who was the original? Pearson Carsten. Have you got any new pedagogies?
Well, to me it seems like it's all the network, the possibilities of networks have the effect that group work, collaboration is possible on a new level. And I get that in terms of quantity, maybe, but in terms of quality, I mean, I wouldn't say that collaborating on a Google Doc is something as more quality than collaborating on a piece of paper.
So yeah, I didn't say it has more quality. I say it has different qualities.
Yeah, but
and if you know how to leverage them in your teaching,
what makes a difference?
Well, for a start, it keeps a track. You can edit, you can delete, you can change the text, and it keeps a track. And you can then go back and reflect on your history of those edits and the process of learning and producing this shared artifact. Now, if you're working on a piece of paper, you can cross something out, but at some point it becomes too messy. You sort of throw it in the bin and start again. So that allows a different form of aggregating knowledge. The other thing is that, for instance, you can stand in the classroom where you, as a teacher, have the Google Doc displayed on a whiteboard behind you. 20 students with their laptops are editing it, and you're orchestrating that phenomena. It's hard to do that with paper.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, you're listening to Question Time live on DS106. Question Time is a special Pontedusky production for Online Educa Berlin. And we're going to take our next question from Twitter. Deborah Arnold says, Question Time panel, what's your thoughts on entrepreneurial skills? Are entrepreneurs, 140 characters, it's hard to ask a question in, isn't it? Entrepreneurial skills are the most important skills to teach. Do you agree?
Rubbish.
We start with you.
Yes, I think entrepreneurial skills are important skills to learn. And it becomes particularly important under conditions of constrained resources, because what that demands is different new approaches to one's condition and finding ways to rise above it, finding innovative ways to survive. And in that sense, often the conditions influence the ability for people to be open to finding ways to survive. As they say, necessity is the mother of invention. And it becomes a particularly important skill in the sense that a number of institutions, certainly in Africa, are adopting and developing entrepreneurial programs to not just teach entrepreneurialism amongst their students, but also amongst their staff and administrative staff included, which I think is quite positive.
Raymond, take you next on this one.
I think on the one hand, yes, it's important. On the other hand, the basis of those entrepreneurial skills, to me, are that you teach children very young, that you teach them autonomous thinking, to question everything, even power. Every rule should be questioned, not because you have to break them, but because you need to know why they're there or what their use is. And if you don't agree with them, you should question that. And you should ask more. Always press the one I want to know more button. Always ask for more information. If you have that from the start, then the entrepreneurial skills are a natural next step in a way of putting that to practice, if you will, I think.
Yishe, what do you think on that?
I think it's rubbish. I mean, I think that I agree that entrepreneurial skills are important, but the most important thing to teach, no way. I think there's a much greater shortage in values and forward thinking than in entrepreneurship. And entrepreneurship is about creating new stuff. But first, you need to have an idea of what kind of new stuff do we want to create.
And you don't think that has a value base that is underscored by good values?
I think entrepreneurship is a skill. It's a necessary skill. We need a lot of entrepreneurs, but we need entrepreneurs to be guided by what I would see as a right set of values. And I think, just think about my most favorite program to hate on British TV is The Apprentice.
Yes.
Because it's hammering in that image of nothing else matters. If you can make more money, you're good. And I think that's kind of flawed basis for society.
Yeah, but wouldn't you say that that's one form of entrepreneurialism?
Yes,
and that they are, in fact, more collaborative, nurturing, supportive forms of being entrepreneurial, in the sense that it enables one to move or transcend beyond the confines
for
that
sure.
The context imposes upon you.
There's a concept of social entrepreneurship.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
I think we need lots of social entrepreneurs. Right, I'd like to see the social apprentice as a program. Right,
maybe we should start one.
Social entrepreneur, isn't that a makey uppy term? Isn't that something like, oh yeah, we want entrepreneurs, but we don't want them to, be there for the money only. So we want them to be social. But isn't social entrepreneurship? Isn't that in the end, if you move entrepreneurial skills to a personal level, then a lot of people are actually quite social in their entrepreneurial skills.
Aren't you a social entrepreneur, Raymond?
I'm a person. I'm very social and an entrepreneur.
I
want to make money as well. So
yes, but the idea about social enterprise is that you use entrepreneurial dynamics in the sense that you create something new which has a business, a solid business standing. But the main motivation is because you want to make the world a better place, not just make money for yourself.
And Ralph Reinhardt is saying that he agrees with Raymond, and he says that autonomous thinking is the key. Gronja, this question seems to have proved surprisingly controversial.
I totally disagree that it's the most important skill, and I hate The Apprentice too. I'm totally with you. Absolutely hate it. My view is that I think the list of digital literacy skills that Henry Jenkins and colleagues refer to from the States, things like play, transmedia navigation, judgment, etc., these are the key core critical literacies that learners and teachers need to engage with. And I would add to that a 12th one in terms of creativity. I think we need to understand what it's like to be creative in these new environments, in these fast-moving, complex spaces where it's not just about space and time. You know, each of us have fragmented digital identities across our different networks. The way in which we do things is fundamentally changing. So I think those are the kind of things that we need to be concentrating on. And I guess it's because I'm an academic and I don't do business side of things, maybe. But I really kind of vehemently disagree. Finally, some arguments.
Okay, Deborah has asked a question back there. If we can get you a microphone, you've caused the disagreement between the panelists. What's your view on this?
Is this on? It's working. I'm very glad of the reactions that the question got. When I read that and heard it this morning, I kind of jumped off my seat and almost disagreed with three of the elements in there, one being the entrepreneurial side, the other one being the use of the word skill, because I make a difference between skills and competences, and also the use of the word teach, and I would prefer to see the word learn in there. Shafika, I was very, very interested to hear your take, and it kind of made me feel more open to the idea of entrepreneurship. Raymond, I think you made a very, very smooth transition from talking about entrepreneurial skills and critical thinking. And Gronja also picked up on that, and Yushe as well. So my immediate reaction when I heard this statement this morning was, no, it's not entrepreneurial skills, it's critical thinking.
Can I ask you where you heard that statement for our radio listeners?
Sorry, it was in the plenary session. I think it was...
again, those plenaries.
It was Peter Novak who said that on his slides.
So this was where Peter Novak gave a plenary session this morning at Online Educa Berlin. These are big sessions, which seems to have caused a lot of controversy. Okay, in fact, I'm going to take a question which came in by email now. We've got questions on Twitter.
Questions come
in by email, yes, sir. And it's about technology. If the panel had a crystal ball, what is the one major development they would forecast for the next 10 years? So I guess that can be a technology development, an education development, a social development. Yishe.
Oh, can you start with the other end? I need to think about this one.
It's not stopped people before. Okay. Shafika, what major development would you forecast in the next 10 years?
I think we're already seeing the beginning of a wave in the mobile learning space in countries that are less developed economically. And certainly in Africa, and I think certainly over the next 10 years, that is going to emerge more as a ubiquitous form of access to learning, especially for underprivileged and marginalized communities in Africa. And it may well lay the basis for an African renaissance of the kind that we've seen in North Africa and the Middle East.
Raymond.
I'm hoping for teleportation, but I think it will be lifelong batteries.
Lifelong batteries?
Yeah, I'm really sure about that. You know, we lose all the cables. Wouldn't it be fantastic?
It would indeed.
Definitely.
Gronja, what's your view?
Okay, we can go with the boring horizon scanning reports in terms of mobiles being within the 1 year time frame.
Horizon reports are boring? Is that live on
well,
the radio?
I'm on that committee.
Gets herself sacked. What I meant was that's a simple, uncontroversial answer, but we're trying to be a bit more controversial here. I think you're right about the access issue through mobiles, particularly in developing countries, very important. And we've heard about the concept of leapfrogging ahead in Africa, for example, going straight to mobiles.
A controversial comment, yes.
But I think there are still issues also in terms of the digital divide, because although I think it's narrower, it's deeper in many senses. And I think that's going to continue to be a problem. I think we're going to see some fundamental changes in business models in the next 10 years or so. So we're already seeing issues around the impact of free social media through free resources, through free courses like the MOOCs that people like George Siemens are running. So what does it mean for traditional institutions if content and expertise and courses are indeed free? We're seeing new models like the peer-to-peer university offering badging schemes. We're seeing the emergence of the OER University, an international consortium where students can do their learning anyway and then get accredited through established institutions. So I think we're going to see new models in terms of the ways in which institutions operate and how traditional institutions sit alongside newer providers. And I agree, let's have teleporting.
Okay, Yishe, you've had three minutes to think now.
So and I've dug a hole for myself because you know, now the other panelists have stolen all the great stuff. But I'll say something else. I'll say personal energy production. So now, you know, if you think about, I mean, the great thing about the internet is that in distributed information and knowledge production, so broke down the hierarchies. Mm. But we're still dependent on a tightly hierarchical system of energy production. And that has to go. And I think it will go.
So that's your predictions for the future. I've just got time for one more question on today's programme. And that question has come in by Twitter. Members of the panel, what avatars do you use to represent your online identity? And can you explain why you chose them? I'll start with Raymond. Have you got an avatar, Raymond?
I have a picture of myself, because it's me.
Okay, the picture of yourself because it's you. Shafika?
I don't have an avatar, actually. And so I'm not in a position to comment on that.
Okay, so we've got one, a picture of themselves, one not having an avatar. Gwanya, have you got an avatar?
Mine's got wings. Very, very pretty, kind of sparkly, electric blue wings. And she's the little girl next door. She's very tame. She's got jeans and a jumper, and she's got long brown hair.
And Yishe?
Well, you know, I mean, I have my Facebook icon or avatar, and it's just my face, and the only reason is that, you know, I'd like people to recognize me when they bump into me in a conference or so. So, yeah. Very mundane and practical there.
Talking about Facebook, I do have an icon that's Tigger, which any of you will know me is probably quite appropriate.
And that question came, I think, from Jenny Hughes. Jenny, have you got an icon? Do you have an icon for an online identity, and what is it?
I have so many online identities. I've got about 12 avatars to go with them. And even my online identities have different online identities. So my favourite one is a picture of an old lady with rollers in her hair and a cigarette in her mouth. But I have another one where I look like a teacher with a mortarboard, and I've got another one which is a cat, and I've got another one which is a rabbit. And where do you want me to stop?
You have
so you have
multiple online identity disorder.
I do.
So we are getting on to medical matters.
Which is cool.
Just get in quickly. I'm going to move on quickly to try and get in one more question. And this question comes from Alejandros, who asks, oh, it's Alejandro Hamelini, who asks, sitting here.
Or Ali to his friends.
Who is allowed to ask his question live because we don't have to take it from Twitter.
Right. Which of the ones I sent in?
the virtual worlds question.
Okay, the question is simple. For learning and teaching purposes, are virtual worlds dead? Are they dying? Are they dying a natural death? Were they always meant to die?
Are virtual worlds dying, and were they always meant to die? Yishe?
Well, I'm not, you know, I have to confess, I'm not a great expert on virtual worlds, but I think there's, virtual worlds started as a massive commercial enterprise, which seems to be on the decline, but then you have this sort of very slow but constant emergence of open source virtual worlds. And I would keep an eye on that. Now, open source processes are much slower to mature, but then much more robust. So, you know, if you think of OpenSim and platforms like that, they might still surprise us.
Gronje, you inherited a rather large virtual world when you moved to Leicester. Are you going to kill that virtual world off?
Thanks for that, Graham. You can buy me a drink later. Actually, I personally have found it difficult to engage with Second Life. I've gone in and I've it's a bit like standing in the middle of London and not knowing anybody and knowing where to go. And I understand that you need to have some purpose to connect with it. I have been very impressed, though. Paul and our team has been leading on a project called SWIFT, which and they've set up a virtual laboratory for genetic students. And the students can go around and they can interact with the virtual instruments. They can look at slides. They can collect data. And that's actually, I think, a really very good use of Second Life. Personally, as a learner of languages, I've also thought that there could be huge potential as a way of connecting people with language learning. I think virtual worlds are a kind of niche specialism, useful for some things, but perhaps other technologies are more important. And it'll be interesting to see whether they decline or increase in the future.
Can I just take a pause to pick up on something? Let's all come out of the closet. Who can now confess if they're never quite connected with Second Life?
And for our listeners, I mean, it appears to be.
It feels good to let it out, doesn't it?
It appears to be for our listeners about 3/4 of the audience have put up their hands. I wonder if they've been the same number if we'd asked this 2 years ago. Raymond, did you ever get into Second Life?
I did. I didn't like it. But about the virtual worlds, it's probably the same as with the word e-learning. As long as you have to mention the E, it's not there for life, you know. It has to lose the E to become a proper thing. And the same with the virtual worlds, they will go out of beta once you can say, you can just mention that particular world without having to say that it's virtual.
Shafika, have you got an avatar?
No, I've already confessed that I don't yet have one, and I'm happy to learn from the previous speaker who spoke about multiple avatars and learn from that. You know, from a resource-poor environmental context, the virtual world becomes a reality when one has consistent, sustained access to the internet and broadband connectivity, in fact, which remains a scarce commodity predominantly in the education systems in an African context. And for that reason, it hasn't featured within the attempts or the new innovations in education systems in Africa. And so perhaps in that context, it may not yet be dead. It may still be emergent.
And we'll just come back to quickly your views.
Okay, quickly my views. Thanks for those replies. I'm very much in sync with Ishai's response. My reaction to Gronia's about London is that the difference is that there's no one there. And London tends to be heaving. it feels a bit, in my experience and in the experience of many others that have worked in those environments with me, that we are in the steam engine era of virtual worlds, and there's a lot to be improved. They are very clunky, they are very bandwidth hungry, they're very novice and at the moment, and that they have not become mainstream at all.
Is this the right moment to mention the virtual kissing we talked about yesterday?
Back to those themes again. Well, okay. Thanks.
Okay. A thank you to our audience. Thank you to our panel. We've run out of time on today's programme. Thank you so much to all the people who have been tweeting. It's been quite encouraging to watch the flow of information going on. Before we finish today's programme, I've just got a couple of announcements. Question Time is one of three Sounds of the Bazaar special series from Online Educa Berlin. The next programme will be tomorrow from 11 o'clock to 12 o'clock. If you're live at the conference, it's at the Marlene Bar, or if you're listening on the radio, same channel DS106 as you're listening to this programme. Also this afternoon, there's going to be something a bit special. We're holding a radio workshop at 1500, a workshop, and the people in that workshop are invited to help us present tomorrow's show, be it as a floor manager, as an interviewer, continuity. You can play whatever role you like. So that's a workshop this afternoon for producing internet radio, and we're inviting everyone to help us produce tomorrow's programme live at 11 o'clock. Also tomorrow at 16:30 in the Tiergarten at the Intercontinental Hotel, the Open Educational Quality Initiative is presenting the Opal Awards for 2011 for quality and innovation through open educational practices. And I hear rumours that there may even be a glass of wine and a little food.
Apparently not.
Event.
Apparently not. I got that wrong.
It's cancelled. It's cancelled. Well, there we are. But I'm sure it will be an exciting and enjoyable occasion even without the wine.
So there are leaflets around the room, so do feel please feel free to take
them. There are leaflets here for those people who are present live and for those people who are listening on the radio. We'll try and get an interview on tomorrow's programme to explain about the Opal Awards. Okay, we've run out of time. This has been the first Question Time to be presented live on the radio from Online Educa Berlin. We hope you've enjoyed the programme. We'd like to thank the four members of the panel and to thank our studio audience, our live studio audience, for all their participation. And we hope we'll be repeating this experience at next year's Online Educa. This is Graham Atwell signing out from Question Time, live on the radio, live on DS106.